building his soul while he lives. And if he does not build it with some thought and some consideration, he will have a very poor and ill-equipped house when he is forced to depend entirely upon a sphere of activity in which he has had little experience. These things which we call competitive living and creature comforts, gratification, have very little place in the larger psychic atmosphere which is our larger home. And as surely as vitamins and food nourish the body, so according to Paracelsus, virtue, beauty, and truth are the necessary nourishments of the soul. The individual who has not learned to recognize and venerate the good, who has not as yet sensed in his own soul the necessity of the beautiful, the individual who has not been willing to dedicate some part of his complex daily living to the maturing of his inner life, will find himself underprivileged or without an adequate home because he has not built the house in which he is to live. Today we plan for the future here, believing that if we have foresight, we will have protection in our older age. In the Paracelsian concept, we must plan for that other age, that age beyond. And if we do not plan for it with foresight, we shall someday recognize our mistakes. Therefore, that the soul of man, nourished by heaven, is formed by earth. And the individual, rising from a material condition to the level of soul, does so through the release of creativity of consciousness and by practicing those good things which are of the nature of soul. He becomes a living soul while yet he lives in this material world, therefore steps across into a sphere of activity already familiar to him and continues to grow and to live and to learn as he has in this life. But if he has no love of learning here, he steps out into darkness. Not that he can be destroyed, not that he goes to some terrible punishment or perdition, but simply that he goes to sleep until out of experience in the far future, nature brings him back again into objectivity, where he will struggle again and go on and on, until he builds this precious vestment, which must be the garment of his eternity. Thus the soul is another kind of body, a body mingling spiritual and material factors, a body transparent and translucent, a body of light and beauty, a body like the famous garments of glory of the high priest of Israel, the fringes of whose gold-edged robes were hung with the bells of rejoicing. All these things man must understand because he is building the invisible vestments of his soul. So the planets, representing the soul, representing its powers, its sevenfold mystery, and the eighth power, which is the power to generate bodies, these things reside in the soul. Friendships that are real are friendships between souls. Bonds that are lasting are bonds between psychic sympathies and values. Dreams that will go on and transcend death are dreams of the soul. And the great problem of soul is not merely that it is inside or behind man animating him. It is that man himself is becoming a soul, that he is becoming capable of living as a creature of soul, knowing the gods, good and evil. This concept forms a very large burden in the philosophy of Paracelsus, and therefore must be included in his cosmic idea. Now, the third part of man is the body. This body is derived primarily from the four elements and a fifth power, which is a binder. This fifth power is the hypothetical medium known to science as ether. The four elements represent the base substances from which bodies are compounded. And bodies are forms. And forms consist of two principles. A form is always an archetype or an idea plus matter. All forms, therefore, and all bodies are forms, must contain some proportion of idea and some proportion of matter. In ordinary bodies or forms as we know them, there are compounds composing various levels of growth and development. Therefore, bodies are consistent with their species and kinds. And bodies pass through laws of change and growth and development and age. The primary substances of bodies, therefore, are these four basic elements. For bodies are composed of a physical or material earth factor, composed of a humid element, or material factor, of an igneous or fiery material factor, and an airy or atmospheric power. Now, earth, water, fire, and air are all material. And yet, only physical earth itself is immediately and inevitably associated with the stasis of body. Water is also material. And Socrates, in his vision, nearly 400 years before the Christian era, declared that water was composed of tiny units of solid substance and that flowing was the result of these solid units falling over each other. But actually, water was not a fluid at all, but a mass of dry units. We know this is true, but how he found it out, it can only be attributed to the magic of internal imagination. He saw clearly by a power within, which is stronger than any instrument and can take precedence over the most formal process of discovery. But these four elements together, forming body, are brought into a compound, into a cooperative, and from them the corporeal form of man is generated. They support and supply all of the elements necessary, and they are prevented from scattering, separating, or departing, and are held together within a mysterious substance, which Paracelsus said was a kind of invisible glue, and we know it today as ether. It is the binder. It is that something which tells us that all these substances do not move freely in space, but are held within the bounds of their kinds and the laws governing them. We know this is true also of sound, where a radio wave passing through space and apparently formless in itself is not dissipated, but is capable of being reinterpreted by means of an appropriate instrument into sound. Thus we know that these waves moving through space move through a medium which prevented them from being scattered, held them in a rhythmic order and pattern, so that they never lost their identity or became hopelessly diffused. In man, the entire corporeal organism is held thus in this matrix, a matrix of ether. And it is from this matrix that the ghost or the shadow of death is generated. For death is actually the departure of the matrix. It is the separation or breaking down of the etheric binder. The etheric binder departing leaves the material elements, and these immediately return to their proper levels and conditions, unless they are artificially prevented from doing so. But even by artificial means, about the only element that can be held is the physical element of earth. All of the others escape in one way or another. Thus the mummification of the body of the dead cannot hold the watery principle, or the fiery or the airy, can only hold the earthy. So that the mummified remain merely becomes a little bit of earth, separated artificially from its common environment. So out of these four together, these elements combining in their own pattern, bearing witness for the elements of the extensions of energy into matter. By means of these elements, the corporeal structure of man is built up. And this corporeal structure, then, is derived from four worlds. It is a compound, and it is not only held by ether, but ether in turn holds it as archetype. In other words, all forms exist primarily as designs or patterns. And a pattern or a design is a rate of vibration. It is also the form, shape, or kind of thing which inevitably gathers around a certain type, mode, or condition of energy. Thus, energy contains within itself the qualifying archetype. And when it enters and impresses itself upon any formal structure, this formal structure takes the archetypal form of that energy, fills into that mold or matrix supplied by ether, and becomes therefore a physical symbol of this energy archetype itself. Thus, every physical form is a true picture of the energy which enfolds it, which ensouls it, or by which it is dominated. This problem of energy and archetype brings in many interesting bypaths, many of which, unfortunately, we cannot explore. But one or two, perhaps, are worth consideration. We have also mentioned already that a body must be a compound. Even a material body, like a statue, has to be a compound. Even though we may not find in it any traces of the fire, air, or watery spirit, still it is a compound because it is a form. And a form can only exist as a result of two natures uniting. It must result from pattern and matter. And a form is pattern matter. And pattern stands for the principle of intellect. It stands for the power of soul. Therefore, anything which has physical existence has at least rudimentary soul existence. And any physical structure, even an ordinary chair or table, has some kind of a psychic vibratory vortex, because it is a form. And all forms have to have an invisible factor, or they cannot hold together. Thus, things have their laws and principles. Paracelsus pointed out that the simplest of these is the evidence that any physical thing created without obedience to the laws of its purpose is useless. If we build a chair and we do not so structure that chair that it can carry the weight of the person sitting in it, the chair is useless. And in order that it may carry that weight and be a properly structured chair, it has to follow laws. It has to be built by the archetype of chair in man. And it has to fulfill, in a reasonable way, the law governing the purpose for which it is intended. Thus, the chair must be created by wisdom of some level and of some kind. The chair does not create itself. And the fact that it becomes a chair is due to the purpose which activated its construction, and that it fulfills the pattern requirements of chair. The same is true of all bodies. To have significance, they must fulfill the pattern requirements for which they were created. These patterns are not in the body, but are contributed by the builder. Thus, in everything that man creates, he supplies creativity. He supplies the archetype, and his own imagination fashions or frames the design which is later to be perfected. And if his imagination is perverse, then the form which he fashions will not fulfill the purpose which he intends. Thus, there are patterns and laws behind everything. The term form, therefore, is also curiously appropriate to soul. For if man physically and objectively is a body, psychically he is a form. Spiritually he is an essence. So man consists of essence, form, and body. And that part of him which is form, as we said, must be a compound. And the great compound, the supreme compound in the mystery of man, is soul itself. For within it are gathered the most perfect example that we can cognize in our level of understanding of the union of law and substance. The soul is a form, but it is a more volatile one. And because it is less dense, it is more easily modified and moved. Hence, the soul of man is in a state of constant change, whereas the body change must be very slow. Yet even in man, every 7 to 11 years, the body passes through a major and complete change. But in the soul, this change affects not only the structure, but the appearance, the shape, the dimensions. For the soul of man is a mutable body, a body capable of motion, of internal motion within itself. The soul of man is forever changing. And the planets which form the soul have their orbits, and they move into various relationships with each other. For the psychic centers of man rotate around the spiritual vortex or the sun. And these vital centers in man, the planetary soul centers, are also in sympathetic relationship above to the planets. Therefore, the soul is peculiarly under the control of planets. And all planetary effects or aspects which are supposed to operate upon body actually operate upon soul. And these operations are then conferred upon body. The soul is therefore the mediator. The soul is the redeemer of bodies and the firstborn of the eternal. The soul is the only begotten son of the spirit. And it is also the firstborn of those that sleep, for it is the first of those that arise out of matter. The psychic energy arising from matter, arising from the experiences of materiality, is forever returning to its own psychic intensity or integrity. When we suffer, it is not because of the body alone. It is that the impulses of our material circumstances are impressed upon the psychic life. Man suffers not with the body, but with the soul. And had he no soul, he could not suffer. Every nerve testimony is carried from the body to the psychic field. Everything that happens to man has meaning only because of soul. Every important thing which he learns is measured in terms not of how much he stores in the mind, but how much is transmitted from the mind to the psychic center of consciousness. For these reasons, man suffers here below, but it is the soul that grows. Man passes through innumerable physical experiences which are meaningless unless the soul accepts and interprets them. In the same way, man attempting to plan or coordinate the purposes of his life coordinates not with his body, but with his soul. For the soul is the leader of the body. And it is also the one that must pay for the mistakes of the body. But in these mistakes, it pays very largely for its own shortcomings. The soul, then, is this person, is this being. And the soul, as it is reflected downward from the great center of life to become the planet, reflects itself again downward in the body through a series of binders. And the soul is associated with the body through a concatenation of septenaries within the body. The soul's contact with the body is not merely a strange wireless telepathy. It is not something that simply means that whatever happens to the body, the soul becomes aware of. This awareness is due to the intricate construction of the nervous and psychical systems of the body, particularly the endocrine system and the autonomic nervous system. The soul, therefore, seeks itself in man by being placed with its 7 members in the 7 great vital centers of the human body. And the soul, in order to generate and maintain body, must enter into the construction of body by impressing its own archetype upon form or upon matter, thus building form. The various parts of the soul, according to Paracelsus, do not become involved simultaneously. But in the process of embryonic development, one phase or aspect of the soul after another takes control or direction in the development of the physical form itself. All peoples in all parts of the world agree that the life of man, particularly the essence of which he is composed, takes up its natural and inevitable abode in the heart. In the heart, therefore, we have the throne of man's internal life. It is that part of the body which comes the nearest and most approximate to the invisible source above body. The Buddhists call the heart the Saptapana Kavan, or the house of seven rooms. For within itself, the heart contains seven distinct parts, or orifices. And in these, according to Hermes, the spirit first manifests its seven souls. Therefore, Paracelsus likened the heart to a solar system, with the sun in the center and the planets moving about through the mysterious processes of heart function. From the heart goes forth the great river, which is to be the great arterial system. And the consciousness of man, therefore, the life of man, is centered in the heart. And there also are gathered the seeds or roots of the seven psychic natures. For the soul exists primarily in the magnetic field of the heart. That is its link to the body. Now, having established its own invisible archetypal nature within the shadow of the spiritual wing in the heart, we can understand perhaps a little better why the statement is made in the scriptures that as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. The heart, therefore, is that part of man which is the closest to his spiritual nature, and is also the armament protecting the soul and the psychic field. The arrangements of the psychic nature, therefore, though they may be registered variously, nearly always result in a heart disturbance. And any wrong function or development of man will ultimately affect the heart. The Chinese physician is able to have his patient put his hand only through a hole in a curtain, and taking the pulse of the person, can tell immediately almost any ailment, physical or psychological, from which the patient suffers. It can all be told from the heartbeat, which is the drum of Shiva, the drum of life, the drum which beats the strange rhythm for the dance of the gods. Now the soul, as a separate or primary polarization, is centered in its own objectivity in the brain. The brain, therefore, is the positive pole of the spiritual life of man. And into the brain center, we have drawn the seven positive attributes of psychic energy in manifestation. In the heart, these polarizations are archetypal. In the brain, they become formal. For in the heart, they are essence. In the brain, they are form. And in the generative system, they are body. The psychic pattern reaffirms itself in the three great structures of man. If, therefore, we study the brain, we shall discover in it, as Paracelsus points out, a complete organism again. A strange and mysterious cosmos connected to the body by the isthmus of the neck. This mysterious body has its constellations in the frontal lobes of the brain, its planets in the posterior lobes of the brain, and within the internal parts, the ventricles and the organs within the brain itself are to be found the root manifestations of the psychic faculties on the level of form. Here then we have formalization of ideas in thought. formalization of emotion so that we can name the 40-some emotions of which man is capable. Here, impulses are reduced to categories, and here these categories cause them to assume recognized and understandable appearances. Here also, we have the seat of the reflective powers of the individual. We have here the gathering up of the testimonies of the sensory perceptions and how they are regulated and digested. And here is the means by which knowledge and learning begin their mysterious alchemical transmutation into understanding or experience life realization. The posterior or physical element parts of man's nature, the elements, have their seat in the generative system, which is the eighth power of the soul. And here we have the cluster of the elements and the laws and principles by which they are governed. And we also have the negative powers of the soul, representing those parts of it which are completely immersed in matter at the present time and have only instinctive or instinctual manifestation, being still locked in a material state. This is the same principle that we find in St. Augustine's description of the city of God and the city of evil. According to Augustine, the New Jerusalem, or the city of God, was located in the upper part of the world, in the corresponding to the brain. And the city of Babylon, the city of darkness and death, at the lower end of the spine. And they were connected by a mysterious ladder of 33 rungs, symbolical of the human spinal cord. All these mysteries are the universe stamping itself upon man. And when Jesus said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will build it again," one of the disciples asked, he meant the temple of his body. Therefore, the symbolism was not unknown even in those days. It's the mysterious analogy between the universal house and the personal house in which man lives, and the distribution of all these energies and their relationships. Up to the time of Paracelsus, very little was known concerning the development of such structures as the endocrine glands. We know that there are 7 primary and important ductless glands, and that the master of the endocrine arch is the pineal gland in the brain, although scientists today would rather prefer to think of it as the pituitary body. But we have here a mysterious necklace of 7 beads, 7 mysterious instruments, which are again used in the dissemination of soul into body. Now, just as surely a soul works through every tissue, as it works locally through the great digestive alchemical structure of the brain with its numerous parts and developments, so it is also capable of a kind of psychic release through the autonomic or sympathetic nervous system and the endocrine chain. Now, it seems that we have an interesting problem here. We have talked mostly up to this point of the power of the soul manifesting itself as the energy, the conditioned archetypal design, impressing itself from itself upon body. We have to approach this again in another way, for upon the ladder which Jacob saw in his vision, angels ascended and descended. Therefore, just as surely, a subjective life moving downward by psychochemical processes takes hold of, sustains, and molds the body into the purposes of the psychic nature. So man, objectively, is also attempting to move inward from the external sphere of his activity towards the source of his own life. He is seeking to become consciously aware of these processes that are unconsciously occurring within him. These motions of life to sustain him are automatic. He is not even aware of most of them. They happen. They are the ever-present proof of life. They arise from sources which he does not understand and produce effects which he does not understand. Yet he lives. And because he lives, he bears witness to a tremendous conspiracy of factors working together to make this mysterious and yet apparently very simple phenomenon possible, the possibility that he lives. Man, therefore, is consciously also seeking to know why he lives, how he lives. He is seeking in science to discover the laws of his life. He is seeking in philosophy to discover the purposes of his life. And he is seeking in religion to discover the sublimity or the divine goodness by means of which all things are justified, necessary, and important. Thus he is seeking from his objectivity to conquer the invisible subjectivity of himself. And here we have, therefore, two groups of functions or processes which are particularly concerned with the reaction of experience, consciousness, or objectivity upon the psychic self. And of these reaction centers, perhaps the most balancing of all is the endocrine chain. The endocrine chain is peculiarly a two-way structure. It not only causes energy to move from the psychic self into the body, animating it and rationalizing it. It also causes the human being to have a series of conscious reflexes which become available to the soul. And it is through these endocrine structures and the sympathetic nervous system that the things we learn objectively become available to soul as soul power. They convey, carry the messages, and help to maintain the equilibrium between the objective and the subjective. The autonomic ganglia has been referred to as the soul system in the body. The ancient writings tell us that this soul system, which is in a more direct rapport, because it is the system in which man is becoming soul conscious, that ultimately the autonomic system will take power over the cerebrospinal system, transferring the authority which is now vested in the mind as the administrator of the seven powers of the soul back to the heart, wherein these soul qualities may be known only apperceptively as spiritual experiences. This is a little difficult to explain briefly, but the point is that man is today reacting to laws which he does not understand. As man grows and becomes master of the use of laws, and becomes self-conscious and able to personally cooperate with universal law, these system processes, which have been involuntary, become voluntary, and the human being attains to the personal, voluntary control of his own life. But this is only possible when the bond between the objective nature of the individual and his psychic field has been so intensified and strengthened that man governs body with soul. Until this is possible, soul governs body without the direct assistance of man. But as man becomes of age in terms of soul being, he takes over the government of himself. And as he takes over the government of himself, he becomes a sun. He becomes a luminous self-center instead of being a reflector of light. Paracelsus worked out all of these and countless other analogies through his study of the human body. Now, recognizing that the spiritual life of man is more or less identical with the sun, with this luminous center that is located in the heart, we come to the next problem. The sun in the human heart must have fuel. And this fuel must be derived from the human equivalent of space. Therefore, somewhere in man, there must be an available link with space. Now, space is the dark earth. Faith is this mysterious substance, invisible and intangible, from which life oozes into manifestation as though drops gathering like rain and falling. Where in man, therefore, do we have this mysterious space dimension? And Paracelsus says that the space dimension in man is located in the marrow of the bones. That it is the bone marrow that corresponds most nearly in the human constitution to the universal field of dark potential, and that the human body is in a mysterious way dependent upon this mysterious bone marrow, and that this bone marrow, if it becomes deranged or injured, or is no longer able to supply the necessary energies, that this bone marrow, if anything fails, this failure immediately represents itself in active function by the loss of the necessary life principle or the depletion of it, so that the various fields of light and power in man lose the root of their fuel. For the flame that burns in the heart has its roots in the marrow of the bones. And bone marrow is the space. And all the cells and all the life of space come out of the invisible darkness. And in man, they come out of the bone marrow. So he was rather interested in the mystery of bone marrow and of the tremendous spiritual reality that was locked in it. If God is in the heart, this enormous field of God, where the seeds grow, directly relates to the marrow and its power to forever bring forth life. For the dark space dimension is forever fertile with life. Life drops from it into manifestation. In man, life drops from the bone marrow. This presents another analogy with which he was so much intrigued. If, therefore, we come gradually to the summary of the Paracelsian doctrine, what do we really gather from all the things that we have been trying to learn? I think we gather that we have been dealing with a person strangely and marvelously ahead of his time. An individual to whom science is indebted for many things. And in a great many instances, science, following the little light of his lantern, has made great and benefiting discoveries. But Paracelsus, because he had imagination, because he had this creative vision within himself, has gone beyond our present achievement in one particular, namely that he has experienced the absolute dependence of all knowledge upon the mystery of inward light. The Paracelsus believed in the total being, that every creature to be understood must be placed correctly in a complete pattern, that no phenomenon can be examined separately. For as he told the professors at Basel, if you separate the cells and analyze them, you will find no life. Because in the process of separating them, you have killed it. Therefore, if you take the living creature, cut off one by one the arms, the legs, and the head, and keep on examining, you will say, I find only death. Because in the cutting off of all these members, you killed it. Therefore, by dissection and autopsy, or by criticism and analysis, you will never find life, because you will kill life by trying to take it apart. The only way you will ever find truth is by putting things together, never by separating them. Every separation is a destruction of unity, and every destruction of unity is a foundation of error. The more parts we accept the further we are from one. And the whole search which man is making in learning today can only be successful if we can continue to unite that which has been arbitrarily divided by specialization, by ignorance, and by the basic inability of the mind of the untrained person to comprehend unity. Thus, unity, to be understood, must be experienced inwardly. It can never be discovered for the sensory perception, because they must, the senses, must bring in separate testimonies. These testimonies remain separate until reason integrates them. And even with reason, they become merely the united but still individual parts until understanding absorbs them. Thus, our entire purpose is to restore bodies that we have killed by separation. We kill human society when we separate the human race. We have retarded the growth of peoples for ages by not overcoming territorial, religious, and language barriers. For everything that separates breeds death. And everything that is separated from the total life of its kind is separated from the great source of its intuitional nutrition. Thus we gain from Paracelsus this vital and important point that we come toward fact as we annihilate intervals, particularly qualitative intervals, and recognize total life of things, realizing that we can never understand the existence of any single creature until we recognize this creature's place in the absolute complete pattern of existence. This means that all our researches, all our efforts, must in some way be directed toward the apperception of the scheme, the plan in which all things are reconciled. Nothing is actually reconciled upon the level of body, because body is an artificial compound which can only be resolved. On the level of body, the natural tendency of all things is to separate. They separate of themselves. They are held artificially together, depending for their temporary survival not only upon the etheric binder which holds them, but upon the soul continually impressing upon them its signature or its archetype. And they exist only because the soul is subconsciously holding them by a kind of meditation, a yogic power which is resident in the soul and which holds these archetypes. The soul also is a compound, but according to Paracelsus, it is a natural compound. It is a compound, therefore, of compatible parts, and the seven parts of the soul are the seven elements of the great alchemical mystery. They are the seven sacred metals. Now the soul as a formal structure consisting of its fixations and its phobias and its complexes, its mentations and its emotional reflexes, this structure or compound cannot be in its manifestation completely integrated. It cannot be coordinated into a state of unity. The only thing we can achieve is a condition of more enduring compatibility. But, as Paracelsus points out in alchemy, if the seven powers of the soul are reduced to absolute simplicity of basic essence, these essences are compatible, can be united, and out of the seven powers of the soul, transmuted, from their objective to their ultimate subjective nature. These seven powers, the lapis philosophorum, or the stone of the wise man, can be fashioned. The philosopher's stone is the perfect amalgamation of the seven essential natures of the soul. These natures, to be adaptable, must pass through birth, maturity, and death. Therefore, it is only with the death of the individual elements of the soul, the voluntary death of renunciation, that the essences can be completely cleansed of their burden of individuality and thus be made susceptible of complete union in the formation of the hermetic medicine. The soul then is again the phoenix, which rises from the ashes of its own dead. It is the symbol of the alchemical mystery, the mystery of the word which is made flesh, and then in turn, by being spoken, transforms all things into soul power. Beyond this is spirit, or essential nature itself, which is not a compound. For spirit is the only fact in the universe that is not a compound. It has neither a positive nor a negative pole, nor is it the product of the mingling of other things. It is essential and necessary and substantial in its own nature, subsisting forever in its own essence, nourished eternally by itself, and nourishing all other things from itself. Because it is not a compound, it is immortal. And because it is not a compound, it is. But having no form has no definition. Yet being formless, it is the root of form. For from it comes the soul archetype. But the moment a thing creates or manifests as a formal structure, it establishes an interval between itself and essence, and can never be reunited with essence until this interval is restored, overcome, or transmuted. The inevitable and ultimate end of all things is their re-identification with essence, this essence being substantially God. The true total nature of the consciousness of this essence is unknowable, but it must be regarded as total. Therefore, it is consciousness without objective or subjective, without subject or object in itself, a total consciousness as total awareness of totality. In this concept, then, the universal mystery unfolded by soul flowing from spirit and into body. The great regeneration or redemption of life is the reversal of this mystery, by which man, through the voluntary statement of his own conviction, resolves to reverse the process, causing body to flow back into soul and soul to flow back into spirit. The involutionary process is involuntary. The evolutionary process is of two kinds, either immediately voluntary, as in the case of the initiate, who has become master of the rules, and in a slower but still voluntary way through the process of evolution, the means by which the individual is gradually strengthened in his understanding and to be made sequentially the natural resolutions which accomplish his regeneration. The difference between nature and art is only in this, that art can perfect nature by intention. All growth is moving in nature, but man has the power to grow more rapidly through the voluntary dedication of his own life to those activities which are essential to growth. Man, therefore, is like the gardener, who is able to assist the plant to grow and to protect it from weeds. man is able to do the same thing in connection with his own country. The subject, therefore, of the Paracelsian philosophy is essentially man. The object of this philosophy is man coming to know the great road by which he came and along which he must return. For surely, this is a kind of ladder to the stars. The individual is here not to remain here as a patient creature from the cradle to the grave, but to remain here to grow in order that he may outgrow mortality through the integration of his objective and subjective life in soul unity. And having attained equilibrium upon the level of soul, then to repeat the process on a higher level, thus restoring soul to the spiritual root from which it came. All arts and sciences are useful only to the degree that they advance this cause. All true knowledge advances this cause, knowingly or unknowingly. All false knowledge interferes with, restricts, or limits this cause. Therefore, it is the responsibility of knowledge that it shall do all possible become faithful to its trust and capable of fulfilling the ends intended. Man is not intended to be wise alone. He is intended through wisdom to achieve the active work of his own existence. For knowledge, wisdom, and understanding are valuable only because they cause the individual to make the conscious decision of growth. And through this growth, to proceed along the path of the great transmutational redemption, or the transformation of mortality into immortality, and the restoration of the tremendous spiritual reality which is at the root of his being. In substance, that is the Paracelsian morality, the Paracelsian ethics. But our time is more than up. We must now leave Paracelsus and hope that each one of you will go on and be friendly with this grand old man who had many enemies because of his brusqueness, but also had many friends because of the fearless way in which he defended those principles which he held to be true and sacred.